Well, you've probably done a few more wine toasts than I have. Do you have any toasts that you'd like to toast, or would you like me to lead us off?
You know what? I think we should be toasting to new friendships, continuing success, and making our community better by educating and really experiencing all Bellingham has to offer.
Awesome. And keeping people clean.
Here we go. Keeping Cheers. People clean. Cheers.
Welcome to Building Bellingham. I'm your host, Leo Cohen. Today, I'm super excited to sit down with Anne-Marie Fayola with Brambleberry.com. She is just an absolute inspiration. Today, she gives us a window into her life as the CEO of a multi-million dollar company, and also into the mindset that fuels her life, that the relationship with customers is a privilege, and to get someone's undivided attention for 12 minutes on a YouTube video is a gift, that people yearn to create something meaningful, and that strong habits enable you to build a life you don't need a vacation from. So welcome, everybody. We have Anne-Marie Fayola here on Building Bellingham, and we're on episode 5.
Wow.
And yeah, we made it.
We did it.
We haven't been canceled, and it's not because of me. It's because of our crew. So they're pretty awesome. But so thanks for coming in. We have the Soap Queen, and we're gonna dive a little bit more into what that means. But you are the Soap Queen. Tell me more about what it means. What is the Soap Queen?
What's a Soap Queen, and how did I become a Soap Queen?
Yeah.
Who bestowed that honor?
Yeah.
Soap Queen is something when I went to MIT to go back to school to kind of figure out how to run my business at the age of 27. My teacher, Vern Harnish, said, you know what? You need to own your corner of the marketplace. So you need to say whether or not you're like, say, and his example was dry cleaner. So he's like, be the dry cleaning king or queen of your town or the neighborhood. And just whatever it is, own your space and then grow it and grow it and grow it. And so I was like, gosh, what would I want to do? Because at the time I was selling raw materials to manufacture soaps and toiletries. And I was like, well, I'd really like to be the Soap Queen. But of course, no one could buy soapqueen.com, right? That domain was totally locked down.
Who had that locked down at that time?
There was a woman, this lovely lady. It turns out she was lovely. And I started sending her notes in the mail and sending her soap in the mail and explaining why I wanted soapqueen.com and how I would use it for good. And when I finally got her on the phone, it turned out, and this was, you know, 13 years ago, she had turned down a $500,000 offer from like Days of Our Lives or one of the soap operas to get soapqueen.com. But she loved my story and she loved the entrepreneurial aspect of it. And she was pretty heartened by the consistency that I had sent her notes and the gifts and all of that. And she kind of took pity on me. And so then we kept in touch for almost a decade after that. And she was so happy with how I used the domain name to teach people how to make soap in their own homes. And she felt really good about it in the end. And I felt really good about it.
So you came into her and you just showed her what you were about, what you were doing.
Authenticity. This is what I'm doing. This is how I'm going to change the lives of people worldwide by adding creativity into their lives and letting them make better products than they can buy on the shelves. And can you help me do that?
That's so awesome. That's great.
It felt really good at the time and it still feels good.
Well, and I looked at the website and it's fantastic. So you've taken Soap Queen, which was probably just sitting there. It went nowhere.
Right.
And you created this amazing website. And we'll probably dive more into that a little bit further in.
Sure.
But I want to talk about you and how you got here, because you have such an amazing background and how, like, it's totally, I think I heard somewhere that when you were a kid, you wanted to be an FBI agent.
Oh, I did want to be an FBI agent. That is a true story. When I was a kid, I was super entrepreneurial. I bred Russian dwarf hamsters and sold them in high school.
What kind of hamsters?
Russian dwarf hamsters. They were a specialty kind of hamster I could make more money on.
Can't get them at PetSmart?
Well, no, at the time you couldn't. And then my dad's a doctor and he helped me design like a birth control system for the hamsters so I could control their breeding cycles and all the things.
Wow.
Yeah, it was good times.
How many hamsters are in a litter?
Well, 8-ish.
Eight.
So like if I could control their breeding cycle, then I could go around, and it was Lewis County, Chehalis, Centralia, mm-hmm. Washington.
So that's where you're from?
Yeah, and sell people hamsters. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't buy those hamsters locally. So that was my little niche. So that's how I made money. And that's how I learned about retail and customer service and placing ads. Back then, it was the classified ads in the newspaper. But at the time, it was a great way to learn about business.
It's and part it was of the process,
all
yeah.
cash business too.
So who bought hamsters?
Well, everybody. Anytime some like little tiny cute furry creatures, like it's a great way to teach your kids about responsibility, right? You don't quite want the dog, but you want something that they need to care and feed for. So hamsters was good. So I did Russian dwarf hamsters in high school. And then since I wanted to be in the FBI, I applied for the FBI and I didn't get in the senior year in college. And they said, we'll come back the next year. And I was moving to Bellingham. And the police department at the time up here wouldn't take anybody that had had corrective surgery on their eyes, like LASIK or any of that stuff.
Interesting. Okay.
And I'm sure that's changed. And so the next best thing was to be a correctional officer. And so I became a correctional officer at a medium security prison in Lacey, Washington.
I know Lacey.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And then I was a correctional officer at the work release minimum security prison up here. And so I really wanted to help people. Like mm-hmm. I had a serious passion for helping people. And corrections was a great way to do that because I thought when I went into it that there was all the cycle of poverty, abuse, lack of education, lack of good nutrition, lack
of
good—
More systemic than anything, right?
Right, yeah. Lack of good role modeling. And so with my sort of Pollyanna-ish attitude, I thought for sure that corrections would be a great place for me to help make a change. And the reality was, is when I got into it, it turns out all the systemic issues were just— it was overwhelming and it felt scary and it felt sad, not scary as in a dangerous physical situation, but just as a hopeless scary, just like, this is not changeable. So I was going home every night and I was making soap.
Why soap? So at that point you're in your job at the correctional facility, down in Lacey, and you're at night making soap. What do those days look like? You go to work. What was your work schedule like? What was your soap schedule like? What did that look like?
Sure. So soap. So I was always a crafty girl. So whether it's knitting or decoupaging or cooking, I love to cook and I love to bake. I love to make paper. I always a crafty girl. And soap was one of these really amazing things where alchemy, like science meets art. And so all of a sudden you take nothing and you make something, and you take something that people actually want and they're going to use. So it's a consumable art form. And with handmade soap, it is really better than the stuff you can buy at the grocery store shelves. And so I was making a superior product. It really matched and met all my creativity needs because you can do a lot with soap. So I would work the night shift. I'd come home and sleep for like 3 or 4 hours, and then I'd make soap. I'd wrap the soap. And then I'd sleep a little bit more. I was doing like the triphasic mm-hmm. sleeping concept. And then I'd go back and work. And then on weekends or weekdays, I would either do store runs or I would try and sell soap at like farmers markets and the like.
I want to know, what is the biggest difference if I go and I buy a bar of Irish Spring? Oh, your favorite buzzword, Irish Spring. What is the biggest difference? Or maybe what's the biggest difference between your soap that you make or that you were making at the time and kind of like the next kind of bigger box, you know, soap product that you could find in Safeway
so
or whatever.
Those types of soaps, like the Irish Spring, for example, is what's called a synthetic detergent bar. So it's typically pressed together detergent. So like sodium lauryl sulfates or kind of harsher ingredients that more strip your skin, which is why you feel like you need lotion after you use those bars of soap. Whereas with handmade soap, it's usually made with like real oil. So like coconut oil, palm oil, olive oil. There's all the retained glycerin. So a soap making byproduct is called glycerin. Glycerin is a clear humectant. Humectant means draws moisture to the skin. Commercial companies strip that out of the soap making process to sell it as a byproduct because that's what you can do. Handmade soap retains all that glycerin. So in general, it's just more moisturizing and conditioning for your skin. And if you buy handmade soap, you can always have it customized to match whatever allergies you have. Say you have a nut allergy or something like that. So
that's
you
amazing.
Won't find yourself having to use lotions or anything because your skin, once it gets used to actually using handmade soap, it'll start naturally staying moist and supple.
So basically what you're saying is the reason I was so itchy back in college is because I didn't have lotion and I was using Irish Spring.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. And plus when you buy handmade, you're supporting small creators.
Yep. That's awesome. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're at, you know, during the day you're at your day job and then you are on this entrepreneurial endeavor.
Yeah. I only worked that minimum security job for 9 or 10 months. And in that 9 or 10 months, there was one guy that got let out in my month 1 and he was back by month 10, which meant he had reoffended, gone through the actual prison system again, had been released again to work release because he was the best of the best and he was back. And that's when I was like, oh, the system is broken. It's so broken the way we have to start all this earlier. And soap making makes me really happy. I'm going to quit my job.
You were in a moment where where you felt, was it despair? Did you feel like a little bit of despair when you saw the same person come through the system a couple times? What was that? What did that make you feel?
Despair, hopeless, incompetent, right? Like, mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, why am I here? What am I doing? Could I make more of a difference? Like, if I was selling soap to people, could I make more of a difference if I was teaching people how to make soap so they could quit jobs that they didn't find fulfilling? And that's when kind of the aha moment hit. And I put $15,000 on a credit card at the age of 20 and ordered my first five kind of raw materials and tossed up a Microsoft Word website for brambleberry.com, which is where I sell all the raw materials to make soap now.
And this is circa 98?
98. Yeah. This is when Amazon was losing 25 cents on every dollar of product it shipped out because no one knew how to make money on the internet yet.
Wow. Okay. So tell me about this process. So you use a lot of social media. You use a lot of media at that time because social media hadn't grown.
Social media wasn't a thing. Facebook wasn't around. Yeah. Google, MySpace, maybe. No, MySpace wasn't even there. Google. Yeah. So it was literally chat rooms. It was like Yahoo groups and chat rooms back in that day. And then email listservs.
And tell me about that. That sounds like a grind.
It was a grind. I worked so much. I still work so much, but it's a different kind of work now. Digital tools are so much easier. I coded my first website, HTML, right? Like the first website, brambleberry.com, had a prodigy.net email address, and it was a Microsoft Word document that I tossed up there with some HTML coding. And the second one was called a Dansie, Dansie shopping cart. And I literally coded it myself because you could learn HTML. HTML is a really easy language to mm-hmm. learn. But now, right, you have Shopify, you have all these just like plug and play WordPress content management systems that are so easy. And back then, none of that stuff was easy. So yes, it was a grind because the tools just weren't readily available.
So you created your own website. It was a direct-to-consumer email.
Direct-to-consumer, yeah. It was, you know, direct-to-consumer. It turns out it's really interesting because right now in, you know, the year we're in, everybody's talking about owning their customers, right? As Amazon has been eating everybody's margins more and more and more and more.
What does that mean to own your customers?
Well, that's it. So like, say, for example, you sell on Amazon. Amazon owns your customer data, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have it, which means Amazon gets to market to them, but you never get them again. Whereas with me, since I don't sell and like I own, it's direct to consumer. I own those customers, which means they give me permission to talk to them and come into their homes every day or every other day via email or via my YouTube channel or via Instagram. And so I get to have a relationship with them and I get to drive their sales. I get to drive their purchases by telling them, hey, I think you would like this. And since they like me and I'm a trusted voice in their lives, because I own that relationship. I didn't give it to Amazon. I didn't give it to Walmart. I didn't give it to Jet.com. I didn't give it to another company.
I love this. So for people out there that are doing some sort of e-commerce business, what you're saying is that when you go on Amazon and you put your product on there, you are relinquishing control over one of the most important pieces, which is your database.
The relationship with your customer.
Yeah.
They own it. And so they have a variety of different ways to sell on Amazon. I just want to be clear. That's not the only way for them to own it. But if you want to be in their warehouses and you want to have them be, and you want to be part
perks,
of the,
right?
the Prime program, yeah. right? Because Prime is a big deal. They own that. You don't get to put marketing material in those boxes, like that type of thing.
So is that harder? I mean, these companies create an easy platform because they want to help you kind of not necessarily cut corners, but get there faster. That's mm-hmm. what the platform is there for.
Right.
But there's a price to pay for that. Tell me more about the process of not taking that, you know.
It's harder.
Yeah. Tell me about
it's
that.
Harder.
Tell me, how did you do that?
So back in the day, how I did it was just to be helpful. And so that meant that I was going on chat rooms and I was literally answering customer service problems that weren't even my customer service problems. Like, I made this soap and it failed. Why did it fail? Or I tried this in the violet color. It went brown. What happened? Or I put lavender buds in my soap and now it looks like mouse turds. Does that always happen? That is a real life example, right? And so I just went on and answered all these questions and became known as the expert. And then when it came time for me to say, hey, I am the soap queen, I really truly was the soap queen because I'd been doing it at that point for, gosh, 10 years. 15 years because I'd been making soap since I was 14. So I'd been doing it for a long enough time that when I said, you know what? I'm the soap queen. Yep, I'm the soap queen. It felt right and it felt good because I'd been donating and giving my time at that point. And so what happened was when people like you and people trust you, they want to buy from you. Right? Like you buy from, think of all the different types of esoteric things that you buy and why you buy them. We buy from Amazon for convenience now. Mm-hmm. But when you're going to buy a high-end stereo system, I don't know they're going to go to Amazon. I think you're going to go in and try and talk to someone, right? Try and talk to a trusted advisor. When we buy wine, if we're going to buy an expensive bottle, we want to go to an expert. We want to go to someone we trust, the authority.
A shout out to the lady at Hagen, the sommelier that helped me out to pick out this bottle. I didn't, just as a disclaimer, I didn't know that Pinot Noir and
French red Burgundy.
Yeah, Burgundy were the same. So,
but it's delicious.
Yeah, thanks to her.
Yeah, it's delicious. So, but again, trusted authority. So you felt good about coming and saying, "Hey, here's this. I know you love red French Burgundies. This is from a trusted authority." And so that's what I did to build my business early on. And early on, it was me. Then all of a sudden, it was two people. Then it was five. Then it was 15. And now we're up to 100 employees. And it's just been slowly bootstrapping it every single step of the way and using whatever digital tools now we can get our hands on to try and reach customers or potential customers where they're at, be helpful, and try and show them how creativity can really enhance their lives and then hopefully have something for them.
That's amazing. So you led with service, and that's mm-hmm. something that really resonates with me a lot. You started by leading with service. You weren't even focused on money at that point. Obviously, you need to make money to live, but you know, you're starting with service. You're starting by answering these questions, becoming the expert, building that relationship. Tell me more about this whole idea of authenticity, because before I even knew you, I looked at social media, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, all of this, and I felt like I was sitting in the kitchen watching you make soap, and I felt like I was right there. I felt really comfortable. So how have you done that, you know, on a one-to-one basis, and how have you utilized social media to do that? Because you've created something really amazing through your social media channels to teach, right?
Well, thank you for saying that, because it's always been this really internal discussion at Brambleberry. Like when we launched our YouTube channel, and I think that was like 13 years ago now, and we have over 100 videos and 22 million views. And it's been a boon for the soap making community, but not necessarily a moneymaker, right? And because you watch a video and then I teach you how to make soap, but you don't have to use my products. You don't have to use Brambleberry coconut oil to make the soap you just watched me make on YouTube. Up until a couple years ago, there was no linking from YouTube to your actual e-commerce site either. So getting someone to watch a video and then go to your website and buy the stuff, that sales cycle process was amorphous. It didn't make any sense. And even now, if you look at the direct click-throughs from YouTube to Brambleberry.com to buy something, it doesn't even justify like 15 minutes of studio time. Like honestly, it doesn't, there's no clear direct correlation. And so one of the discussions we always had at Brambleberry was, okay, there's no ROI. There's no ROI. And I just kept saying, but it's the right thing to do and it feels good. In the sense that like having a relationship with our customers is a privilege. And this is how we have that relationship.
So you thought of it as a privilege.
Yes.
So what you're talking about, if we use the same acronym, would be more like return on impact.
Sure. Because like your time is so valuable, especially if you're our average customer, 97% of them are women. It's very, very, very female centric business. And so many of them are mothers and so many of them are working mothers. So to get someone's undivided time for 12 minutes is a gift. Like, oh my goodness, that is so, thank you. Like that is so valuable. And so that's one example of this whole concept of, well, you're giving, you're teaching, and how does that translate to money? You know, honestly, we don't know.
Yeah.
Like it's not clear. When we talk to our customers anecdotally, they say, oh, I found you on YouTube. Or when I go to soap making conventions, because there are soap making conventions, you know, there'll be lines of people that want to take photos of me because they learned how to make soap from me on YouTube. But again, you cannot see that transactional relationship at all when you are looking.
You've gotten someone's undivided attention for 12 to 15 minutes with your videos. How did you do that? Talk about like, how did you create, like, obviously you're just going up there and being yourself, and it's not like some magic equation, but you're just yourself, and you're just leading with service. But that's a lot of time. We're in a society where I feel like, you know, 30 seconds, like I'm just like, you know,
I'm off.
I'm thinking of something else. What is it about the content that you're creating, besides just teaching, that you feel like is really, that really resonates with that demographic?
Well, I think creativity is essential, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. It doesn't matter how you're creative, and everyone is creative. And so I think that soap making and that, again, that alchemy and that mix of art and science is one way to be creative, but there's so many different ways to be creative. And I think that one of the reasons we get people to stop for 12 minutes to watch this is A, soap making is a science. It's hard. It's actually hard. You can mess it up. So people that actually want to learn how to make soap or make candles, right? That's our next videos that are coming out, our candle making videos. They're going to stop and watch a video because they don't want to mess up their supplies, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that people ultimately watch because people are yearning to create things that are meaningful and things that matter. And when you create a candle that you give to a teacher, that feels so good for them because you made it. You made it yourself. You made it with love. Or when you create something for your daughter that has eczema and she has tried everything on the planet and 6 weeks later, she's not itching like crazy anymore. There is no greater gift you can give your family. And so I think that's what we tap into. We tap into that desire to give, to gift, and to create. And all of those things create meaning and create value in people's lives.
That's amazing. And it's funny because I just want to let you know that I do use soap every day. I know it may not seem like it, but I never really thought about it. It's one of those things that I didn't really realize the impact that just things like socks or soap or whatever it may be, these bare essentials that we kind of overlook on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
So you created this product because it's this company, this platform for, you know, people of all walks of life to feel good and, you know, feel like themselves throughout the day. Is that also part of it?
Absolutely. And for them to have something that they can make with their family, something they can make with their friends, something they can do at night to relax and de-stress. Like that's what I was doing when I was a correctional officer. I was making soap every night to de-stress. And then it was like, oh, there's something here. Okay, what can I do with this? Where can I go with this? And so now I've written 3 books on soap making. Story Publishing came to me and said, hey, soap making expert, you're the soap queen. We'd like you to write a book.
Yeah.
And so each book takes about 2 years to do. And every time I get done with one, I'm always like, I'm never writing another book again. And then a year later, I forget about that. And they come to me again and say, hey, let's write another book. And I'm like, okay.
So what does that take every day as an author? Because you've written multiple books.
Yes. Yeah. So I've written 4 books, 3 on soap making and 1 on how to live your best day ever every day, which is all about kind of lifestyle strategies for how to create a habit-based life so that you, build a life you don't need a vacation from.
And you're also not just the soap queen, but you're the habit queen because,
right.
And we talked about this earlier. You said, I'll be there at 2:45. I work in increments of 15 minutes. And I said, whoa, okay. So tell me about time blocking in your life.
Time blocking is super essential for me. I outsource my time blocking in the sense that I have an assistant who runs my calendar because I say yes to everything all the time. I love to do cool, awesome things. And so if you're like, hey, you want to do a podcast? I'll be like, yes, I do want to do a podcast. And then someone says, hey, can you do this? I'll be like, I can probably shorten up that podcast and then fit that into my assistant. She stops me from doing all that.
So have you always been this way, or did you hit a certain point in your life where you decided that you had to start time blocking? Otherwise, with your personality and the way that you like to have these new experiences, if you didn't start blocking your time out, you're going to start saying yes to things that don't keep you on track with what's important
right,
to you.
That don't really fill me with, that really are fun in the moment, but don't get me to my goals. And so I was a kid in high school that literally, we were talking, in 95, I had a Franklin Covey planner, like the big ones.
Nice.
So I was that kid. So I was always really pretty religious about my time and and blocking my time. And I think partially that's because my dad's a doctor. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, but she was a nurse before that. And so I watched him have to prioritize his time because he did a lot of nonprofit work. He did some political work. And then he was constantly running. He always had a side hustle too. He always had a side business.
It sounds like you really look up to your parents.
Both of them.
Yeah.
So much. Yeah.
Tell me more about, you know, your childhood looking up to your parents. Like your dad was a doctor.
He's still a doctor. He is 70 years old and he is a practicing family practice physician still.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so he had a side hustle, and this is something that you've said that you do too.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of influence did your dad and your mom have on your success and your growth as a human?
Well, my mom was my biggest salesperson as a soap thing. So when I was like 14 and I was selling soap, she was selling soap to all of her friends for me. So she was very into supporting me that way. And when I was like, you guys, I would like to be paid for my cooking. They were my first clients to like pay me $50 to cook on Saturday for cooking Sabbath meals because they're Seventh-day Adventist, and Seventh-day Adventists typically don't do a lot of work on the Sabbath, and that includes a lot of food prep. And my dad really taught me the ability of just deep focus in relationships. He had a few relationships that he was very close with and very just deeply entrenched with, and then didn't do a lot of the extraneous sort of small talk relationships. He was really big and just getting right down into the meat of it. And so he really taught me the importance of community. And then when I quit my job to sell soap, my parents were pretty dang horrified, but very, very, very supportive. My dad helped.
Sounds really familiar.
Yeah. My parents helped me, you know, paint my warehouses. And I moved 5 times in the first like 4 years because Brambleberry was on such a growth tear in the first decade. And they always helped me move, and they were really supportive. I asked my dad for a $5,000 loan for my first Christmas sales. And
did he give it to you?
No.
Oh.
He said no. I offered him 1/3 of the company for $5,000.
How does he feel about that now?
You know, he actually is really, he's very proud of himself for not doing it. Because A, of course, it forced me to figure it out myself. But B, he always said, you know, he wasn't ever going to collect on it. And 1/3 of the company was, you know, too much anyways. So he's proud of himself for saying no.
One of the biggest things that I see with most successful people is the ability to fail forward really fast and learn. And it sounds like you really set aside your ego to fail and understand that you're going to fail and understand that you're going to grow and it's going to get really uncomfortable. Can you give me an example of a time? Like, what is your biggest failure that you've ever had?
Oh, I'm right in the middle of it right now.
Tell me about it.
Super great.
Let's dive into it.
Total lie. It's not great. Brambleberry, it's so exciting and so cool. We have been growing at this really great clip, and we ship out like 1,000 boxes a day to people nationwide that want to learn how to make soap, bath fizzies, lotions, lip balms, you name it. If you can put it on your body or rinse it off, I sell you all the ingredients. And then, of course, I teach you how to make it, right? The blog, soapqueen.blog, or the in the studio at brambleberry.com, or YouTube channels. So we've been growing at a really good rate. And because this reciprocity thing has worked, even though we can't prove the direct ROI. So 2 years ago, we hit the documented limits of where our shopping cart could go, in the sense that we were processing more art orders than the shopping cart could handle.
How do you track that metric?
Well, yeah. Because literally we were starting to have outages, and the website would be going down. And so we were all on like, literally we signed up for a monitoring service. We, meaning the management team and I, and one of us would get pinged at 2 a.m. and someone would have to go restart a server. Right. Like,
wow.
It was not great. And so we went and we were like, okay, you know what? I want to build $100 million company. I want to build an empire. So what platform do I need right now to build an empire? Because I don't want to go through another platform change. Mm-hmm. So we picked a platform that was kind of like going from like a 1964 Ford that I could sort of fix on my own to like literally buying a Tesla. And then I spent this huge amount of money to do a new brambleberry.com, right? New user experience, new, better, like they're called lockers, but like data storage lockers for people so they can save recipes, new photography for the website, all this stuff. And we launched in February of this year with this brand new website, and Google freaking hated the website. They hated it. And so they dropped all of our search engine rankings like overnight. So like overnight, my sales dropped like 42% in February of this year.
Sorry.
Yeah. So imagine you have 100 employees.
Yeah.
And you just launched a new website that you spent much of your savings to develop, and then your sales drop because Google hates your new website.
If you don't mind me asking, what does it cost to make a beautiful Brambleberry website?
Well, I will tell you, the one 8 years ago cost $48,000, and the new one was over $1 million.
Okay. That is amazing. And by the way, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous, right?
I kid you not. You can walk around our office and someone's scrolling through, you know, Instagram or on the website on Brambleberry and going, wow, I've never been so magnetized to soap in my life. So it's worth it. It will be worth it, right?
It will be worth it. So in terms of failures, so like here, my team has worked so hard. We have been knocking ourselves out to build this website instead of doing all the big expansion of stuff we'd like to do, right? Like, you know, when you're building a website, you're head down in all those details and you're not really thinking big picture. You're not figuring out what next trade conferences to go to. You're not saying, hey, Anne-Marie, wouldn't it be great if you keynote at this? Let's figure out how to keynote you at that, right? Like, you are literally down here. So we've spent this whole year working on it and we get it up and sales go whoop, and customers are like, I can't log into my website. I can't log into the website. I'm going elsewhere. So like that was February. So then we did a little bit better the next month and we were only 19% down in sales, but 19% down is still a lot.
Yeah.
And then we were down again the next month and the next month. And so I've spent this whole year figuring out with the team, it's not just me. I have a team of people that are incredible and are so committed to this. Didn't lose one single team member through this.
That's huge.
And huge. It's hard to go to work every day and not feel successful. It is so hard to go to work and say, hey, how are the sales? How are the Google click-throughs? Oh, and you are working so hard and you can't do anything about it, right? So this year's been a huge growth curve in terms of just leadership, how to lead a team through really tough times, cash management, right? So I'd say I'm going through the failure. I'm like, this will be the worst failure I've had yet to date.
How does that feel?
I'm embarrassed. It feels crappy. I hired the wrong people to execute on some of the kind of more technical aspects of the website. And I was clearly not paying enough attention, right? Like I should have been more in the weeds. So I feel like it all rests on mostly my shoulders. I had multiple people at work offer to resign over it and like take responsibility themselves and say, I'm sorry, I should have caught this on me. Of course, it's not their fault and they're amazing team members and I would never take their resignation over this. But so the failure feels personal. It doesn't feel great, but that's where the habit-based lifestyle comes back into play, right? If you're getting up every day at 6:22, you're having your cup of green tea, you're meditating for 10 minutes, you're reading your business book for 20 minutes, and then you're either going straight to work or dropping your kids off at school, or depending on the day, you're getting your workout in first thing. That sets you up right there. Those habits set you right up for the right mindset right away. And so that's where having that habit-based lifestyle saves me. And I think it would probably save most people from hitting those really low doldrums, mm-hmm. Assuming you have normal kind of psychological profiles, right? It'll save you from hitting those real lows. Because if you're meditating every day and you're working out every day and you're drinking your one cup of antioxidant-rich coffee and you're eating mostly fruits and vegetables and a little bit of healthy protein and you're not having a lot of sugar and you're hanging out with people that are uplifting you, that are saying, hey, you know what? It's okay. It's going to get better. Well, what's the one thing you could do right now? It's the swings are so much less.
So it's not that there aren't swings. It's just you minimize these swings by creating habits that and people and surrounding yourself in the right environment that allow you to see if the next, you know, 6 months are going to be tough. It's just here's one step a day. Here's one step a week to get to beyond that 6 months. So you're going through one of the toughest times that you've, one of your biggest challenges that you've had since
professionally,
professionally.
Sure.
What's next for you? What are you most passionate about? What do you want to do next? What is the next step for the company? And
One of the things I'm really good at is reframing. So what that means is, so like this has been a really challenging year, right? Like I just spent most of my savings last year and then sales are down and wow, it's hard to keep morale and it's hard to keep my team happy. And then I'm adjusting to being a single mom now and all of that's, and my mom has breast cancer and it's like all this stuff. And so going through that and saying, okay, here we go. You know why? You know why I had a really bad year this year financially? It was to save me because otherwise, all these private equity firms that have been circling my company for years and years and years that have wanted to buy me, maybe one of them would have given me an actual offer this year that I wouldn't have been able to refuse finally. And instead, I had a bad year and that doesn't feel good, but it's going to bring my team together really close. And guess what? It saved me from selling to one of these private equity firms. So now I'm going to have this company still that's built to last, that has 100 plus employees that maybe I can pass on to my kids when I get older, right? So that's kind of an example of how I reframe all the things all the time, right?
So you're taking something that could easily go down a dark road. Mm-hmm. You could easily say, well, this happened and this happened and this happened and so on and so forth. But you're reframing it in a way that, like, you're, even if it's 1%, even if it's the environment that you put yourself in. So if you take this here, even if it's something that one thing that you could have done better, you look at that one thing, you analyze it, because that's really all you have control over, right?
Right.
So that's really powerful. Focusing on what you can control.
Right. Focusing on what you can control and the story you tell yourself, right? Because the story I can tell myself is, oh my God, I suck as a CEO. A good CEO wouldn't have let this happen. I don't deserve to be doing this. I need to find another CEO. And instead, all I've done is be that, that's one message I could tell myself. And it's a perfectly legitimate, you could go with that answer. But instead, I'm going with the, oh my gosh, this is such a great opportunity to really just bond with my team and come in every single day and work harder than ever. Make sure that I'm staying up until midnight so they see how hard I'm working. Make sure that I'm providing the leadership that they all need and make sure that I am really intrinsically involved in all this day-to-day stuff so we can get this ship righted. And oh my goodness, how lucky am I that I then was able to kind of not be purchased by any private equity companies. Because right now, I don't know if you've heard, private equity has stupid money and they're giving stupid valuations right now for companies. Mm-hmm. So the money that was being dangled in front of me last year, I didn't take, but it was pretty tempting. This year would have been really hard to not take. And instead, I tanked my company. And in doing so, probably saved myself another 20 years of this great career that I love.
We talked a little bit about, and this is not to talk about real estate, but something that I think is something that I've admired about what you've done. And we talked about this when we got together for lunch, which was you bought a building.
Right. Yeah. Diversification of income streams. It's a thing.
Okay. So for people that are starting a business, a lot of people are looking at probably leasing space. What has that done for your business to own the space and have that leverage of the other units and have that other income really help?
So first of all, I'm a big believer in controlling your own destiny, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. And so actually I own the Brambleberry Fulfillment Center as well. And I purchased that when I was either 26 or 27 with the help of a small business loan.
And that's Sunnyland?
That's Sunnyland neighborhood. Yep. And that's a 25,000 square foot building. And it's so funny when you walk through it, I call it the Hobbit warehouse because it's grown and grown and grown so much, but I own the building. So we are in it.
Yeah.
Right. So it is, you know, it's like a maze of corridors and it's not set up or optimized for a warehouse the way I would do it now. But my team certainly makes the best of it. But I bought my warehouse back then because I wanted to control my destiny. I did not want a landlord that would be able to kick me out, be able to raise my rents, or for example, in one of the previous spaces, the one that made me buy my own building, there had been a sewer pipeline that broke or something like that. And they had to dig through concrete in the middle of that, right? Tons of business interruption that I wasn't compensated for and I couldn't plan around because it was the building's owner's thing. And then when we had a groundwater incident, rained really hard and groundwater came up through their open holes and flooded my whole building and all the things. And we lost $5,000 worth of inventory, which at the time was more like probably, you know, $75,000, $100,000 for me today in terms of like the sheer dollar volume. They didn't want to pay for it. They didn't want to take responsibility for it. And so that was my big, like, I want to control my destiny. I will be owning my own building. And so I bought my first building when I was 26 or 27. And then I just purchased a building for Brambleberry Sale and Marketing Team because Fulfillment Center is all about optimization. It is all about getting the maximum number of boxes out the door.
Right.
There is nothing slow and romantic and luxurious and creative about that. This is the way you pack a box. Mm-hmm. This is the way it gets to a customer safely. This is how many items you have to pack in a box. This is how many items you have to pull an hour. Again, very just keep those trains running on time. Being creative is all about space. It's mm-hmm. all about beauty. It's all about, again, this luxury of freedom of time. So I purchased a building specifically so my sales and marketing team could be in it. But of course, I don't need the whole building. And so I do have tenants and it's at a break-even situation / maybe lose a little bit right now. But I think in 5 or 10 years or 10 or 20 years, again, this is a built to last company and I want it. And since I just managed to, again, tank my own company this year, I will be keeping this business for quite some time. So in 10 to 20 years, hopefully that building will pay off financially and I will have divestiture of my income streams and different income streams coming in.
It always does. Being in the business, well, not always, but most of the time, real estate is a great investment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like one of the things I really was excited about when we talked about your purchasing of that building, which was a couple of years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a little bit of tenacity in how you purchased that. Tell me a little bit more about that story.
So I had known I wanted to buy a building, and I know what I wanted creative and marketing someplace else. And so I had been looking at all the buildings in downtown. And so I had been, I knew in my head kind of what everything was sort of worth at that point. And I had been looking at the price per square foot. And so I saw this building or this space, this 1200 square foot space or 2200 square foot space for rent on Craigslist. And I walked in and I said, hi, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out this was the building's owner. And I looked at him. I'm like, well, have you ever thought about selling the building? He's like, no, it's fully leased out. There's no reason to sell it. And I said, well, I do need a space, but I have a lot of ideas on what I want to do with the space. So I will lease this space for 6 months from you. And I will start doing everything I can do to the space to get it ready for me to move into. But if you and I don't have a purchase and sale agreement for me to buy this building in the end of 6 months, I will leave. And he said, I have no intention of selling the building. I said, okay, well, that's fine.
What does that mean to you when someone says, I don't feel it. I don't know if I'm going to sell. It sounds like in that moment, you were like, that means no right now, but that is not no.
Oh,
forever.
Yeah. Every no leads you closer to a yes. Yeah. Like, okay, he doesn't want to sell right now, but he's going to go. And also, people don't like new ideas. Who likes a new idea? No one likes a new idea. Everybody likes where they're comfortable, right? Like That's the reason so many people stay in places of discomfort in their personal lives, even if it's not serving them, because discomfort sometimes is so much more comfortable than actually having to make the change. No one likes change.
Interesting. So it's obviously, it's always harder to do the right thing. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. But That's why people stay in bad relationships, right? Because that discomfort feels actually comfortable for them. That discomfort feels normal to them. And making the change is harder and scarier. And it's the unknown. And so no one likes new ideas. So I knew he wouldn't like the idea right away. Plus it was fully rented. Why would he like it?
He's cash flowing it. He's in a good place. There's no reason for him to change what's broken.
And
right?
So then I went back the next month and, you know, I said, hey, here's how things are going. How are you doing? You thought about selling the business? No. Or the building? No, I'm not going to sell. Month three goes by. Hey, same thing. What are you thinking? And then he sent me a text message and he says, hey, you know what? I'll get the building appraised. And if the building appraises for what I would sell it for, then I'll sell it to you. And I said, great. Get the building appraised. It's going to appraise for this. And because I'd been looking at all this stuff. And so I knew exactly what I thought it was going to appraise for. And I just flat out told him what I thought it was going to appraise for. So then he comes to me and he says, and this is a 45-minute meeting over like green smoothies, wheatgrass. And he says, here's the appraisal. Kind of puts it on the here. But it appraised for lower than I would want to sell it for. I think it's worth more.
And how did you know? Did you have any real estate background? Any sort of, I mean, you had purchased a home at that point. Purchased a few homes at that point. So you had some real estate knowledge, but more so from a business perspective, how did you evaluate that? How did you say, oh, this is worth 1.6 versus 1.8 versus 2.5?
Well, so I had looked for 2 years for a building downtown. So I knew exactly what the price per square foot was going in all these different streets. And then I kind of knew where my street was and kind of what the little small haircut you'd want to take for being on that street versus being on the main street, right? Mm-hmm. And also the building makeup and what it was, you know, did it need repairs, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of had it in my head what I thought the building was worth. And so I said, well, this is what it's going to appraise for. So he sat me down. He says, you know, this is what it appraised for. And I want more. Now, of course, you know, as a realtor, that's a problem. If it appraises for something and he wants more, I have to come up with that difference because a bank isn't going to loan me 80% of his value. It's going to loan me 80% of appraisal value.
Correct.
So I said, okay, what do you want? And he named his price and I said, okay. Cause I knew it was right within it was 5% more than I was in my head willing to pay. 5% to own my own destiny and to control that future.
So you made a decision, and this is really interesting, kind of dissecting your brain if we're gonna get really, you know, scientific on this. But I'm very interested in that moment where a lot of people, I feel, in moments like that, decide to cut their costs and you being a very analytical person in that moment said, no, the 5% is going to pay itself back.
It's going to pay itself back.
Was that from experience? How did you make that decision in that moment?
Well, first of all, like you, I believe real estate is generally always a good thing, right? Especially in Whatcom County. We're growing. We're a climate refuge. We are like we're always named one of the top 10 places to live. You know, this place is amazing. Real estate values haven't gone down. And yeah, the economic harbingers are not real good right now from a nationwide standpoint. And I also look at what happened during the last recession for Bellingham. not a whole lot happened to our housing prices. They sort of went down a little bit. They stabled out. The inventory went up, but not a lot happened. They're not making more commercial real estate downtown, right? Like, what? Where are you going to build? You're not, right? And so I looked at that and went, that's a bet I'm willing to take. 5%, I'll make that up in a couple of years. It's okay. And so I said, okay. And so we drew up a 2-page Word document. It was like literally one page and one paragraph. We walked over to Whatcom Land Title. We said that we'd like to open up and this is a big building purchase. And I said, we'd like to open up a file and we want you to close in 22 days. And they went, well, huh? What? I said, yeah.
And just for the record, your typical purchase and sale agreement with, you know, the standard addenda is, you know, probably 15, 20, sometimes even more pages.
Oh, most of mine are always longer. Yeah.
Contingency. Uh-huh. But so you went there with a
1.5.
I don't
want to
call
document.
It a napkin agreement, but it's
literally
kind of a napkin agreement. Did you write this up or did you have a lawyer write this up?
No, he wrote it up. The seller wrote it up and I looked at it and I was like, all right, that's fine.
And so you went down to Whatcom Land Title and typically on a larger purchase, I mean, typically a standard single family purchase, you're buying a home, you know, you could probably do it. And I've seen them happen in as little as 10 days if you have a cash offer. But typically with lending,
right,
you need 30 or 40 days.
And I was doing a credit rate swap deal too. So that's a really sophisticated financial instrument because I was betting rates were actually going to go up. Turns out, by the way, that was the wrong bet. Thank Trump economy.
Yeah.
Right. And so Umpqua got it closed for me in 22 days. And that was that. And then me and the former owner, you know, he walked me through the building. He gave me the keys and we've texted maybe once or twice since. And that was that.
So there's a pro and a con to it. And I would say the con is not as bad as it's only as bad as we allow it to be. So like the pro being that you're in control of your own destiny, the con being that you're like, I'm in control of my own destiny. If this thing tanks, like if the economy tanks, if the whatever, like I own this building.
Right. And it's a big mortgage.
It's a big mortgage.
So how do you sleep?
How do you sleep? Well, you get up at 6:22. So,
right.
Yeah.
So don't sleep long.
Yeah. Don't sleep long. So that puts even like basically what it sounds like you're doing is that this accountability structure that you've created around your business and around your life, it just doesn't give you another option. And when you don't have another option, when you burn the boats.
Right. I love that phrase.
Tony Robbins, when you burn the boats, you'll take the island, right? Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you've burned all your boats.
Yeah. No, burn all the ships for sure.
Yeah.
There is no option but to succeed. No, I'm not stupid in the sense that like, I'm not ignorant of the potentials. And so I certainly have fallback plans on like, okay, if this went south, I could sell this. If this went south, I could do this, or this is how much cash on hand I need and that kind of stuff. I always have contingency plans, but I, knock on wood, I don't plan to use them.
So would you say you're a realist or an optimist? Because I know you're not a pessimist.
I call myself a delusional optimist because
delusional optimist. Because, what does that mean?
Well, I think that in order to start a business and to say, you know what, I can do this and I can be responsible for myself and all these other families, I think you have to have a certain amount of like glasses, not only half full, but it's basically always full all the time. And yes, I can do this and you can do this and we can do this together and we're going to do it and it's going to be fine. And I know this looks insurmountable right now, but it's okay. Here's the promised land and here's the finish line and here's how we're going to get here. Let's do it together. That takes more than just optimism. A lot of times that does take putting on the blinders, right? That takes me going, wow, we're down 42% in February. You know what? It's going to be fine. Here we're blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Right. Instead of going, we're down 42%. Oh my God, I'm going to sell my house. I'm going to ask for a loan. I'm going to lay this people up, but I haven't laid anybody off. I will not be.
You should be proud of that. That's amazing.
Right. Like, and just made the decision that we are going to get through this. We're going to come through it. I will be able to solve this. My team will be able to solve this and we're going to do it together.
So tell me a little bit more about the core of your company. You talk a lot about together, which I can tell. You know, you had your mission, vision, values on the wall when I came to your office. It's so important to have that because you know you can't do this alone.
No, and I don't want to do it alone.
Yeah, and so first of all, what are your mission, vision, values?
Mm-hmm.
What's your core? And how do you continue to present that and to give that to people and remind people of that work for your company to remind them of the mission?
Well, so at our heart, we are all about creativity, right? Our mission for Brambleberry is that we believe people are creative. We believe that creativity helps you lead a life of love. And we believe that we are the best people to help you do that. And so that is kind of our, like, how we want people to look at us in the marketplace and why we do what we do every single day. And then internally, we have a kind of a set of values of how we treat each other, right? We pause for compassion. We make sure that we are adventurous, meaning what's your idea? We do want to hear it. We are going to try for new things. And then we try really hard to use these kind of internal things about pausing for compassion and being friends for life. And
what does that mean?
Friends for life means that we treat you as a person before we treat you as a number or an employee. Does that mean you don't have standards? Nope, because being friends for life means that if you don't show up for work for 5 days in a row, I'm not being a very good friend to your coworker if I don't actually say, hey, you got to show up for work or else you're not going to have a place here anymore, right?
So it's this idea of like radical candor where you say, like, I care so much about you that I'm going to be really brutally honest with you. You may not like it, right? But mm-hmm. but that's what a good friend does. When it comes down to advice that you have for other people, because there's a lot of people that I know look up to you. There's a lot of people who don't know you yet, which this is the whole goal of this podcast, to get to know you, that will look up to you. I look up to you. I don't know you incredibly well, but we're getting to know each other better. And I admire you in a lot of ways. And I think that I'd love to have some advice that you would pass along to your younger self, which could also be passed along to other potential entrepreneurs or wantrepreneurs like myself.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that, well, so A, I wrote an entire book about like my whole like just life philosophy synthesized, which is basically me giving advice for 280 pages. So there's that. Definitely read the book on how to live your best day ever. Literally for 10 years, if not 15, people would be like, hey, how's it going, Anne-Marie? And my answer was always exactly the same. It's the best day ever. It's the best day ever. It's the best day ever.
What if it was the worst day ever?
It didn't matter. It was always the best day ever because it was always a mindset thing, right? Because it doesn't matter what your situation is. It's your situation no matter how you are acting about it, right? Like, I don't want to jinx us by saying anything, but like if a meteor came down and hit over there and all of a sudden it's just us six or whatever in a studio and this is all we have, we can either have a really great attitude about it or a really crappy attitude about it. We're still stuck in a studio with only 4 ounces of wine left.
Uh-oh.
And a meteor over there, right? We can have a great attitude about it or we can have a bad attitude, but we are still in the same exact situation. And so my day was always the best day ever. And it is pretty much still always the best day ever. So that's where the title of the book came. But in terms of advice, really my number one advice that has been with me since I was a very young child, my parents had to ban books from the dinner table because I read so much, but it's leaders are readers. Like there is not one single subject that you want to know about that 20 people, 40 people, 150 people haven't written books about. And now thanks to the internet and thanks to podcasts and thanks for those things, those people are amplifying their voices with podcasts and with YouTube videos and with articles that they're blogging about on Forbes and the like. And so you can learn anything you want from any leader about anything at all times. And so devote yourself to improving yourself by reading. And if you want to go an extra step further, make tiny little book clubs around the reading. So for example, I have a business book club that I do that I read the same book with 7 business people every single month. And we talk about the business book. We talk about practices that we're taking away from it. And we help keep each other accountable.
And just to define that, because for me, I learn a lot better from an auditory perspective. So I listen to a lot of Audibles mm-hmm. and I do podcasts. Would you still define that as kind of the
Absolutely.
Same?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. It's however you're getting your learning in.
So I can be a leader.
You can be a leader. Yeah. Just be taking in ideas from other thought leaders and synthesizing them, right? Throwing out what doesn't work for you based on your practice or taking it in and going, that's an interesting way to think about that, right? Or, I like that practice. I want to add that to my life. And then what sometimes me and my different groups of people will do is have accountability groups around one particular habit. So like 6 months ago, we were sending each other 5 different things we were thankful for a whole month, but we had to come up with new things every single day.
And that's hard too, right?
Well, you know, by day 5, you've moved past your family and your friends and your house and your car and your like things, your job that you love, right? By
day 5. When it's the best day ever, every day.
Every day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotta live up to that, huh?
Right. But like, so today it's like, if I'm on day 27 of 30 days of coming up with all brand new things, I'm going to be thankful for this wonderful French burgundy you've provided and this fun, entertaining ability to talk for an hour and a half about myself, which I mean, who doesn't love that? Thanks.
Well, I'm really enjoying it.
So leaders are readers, definitely the number one advice. And number two is business is a marathon, not a sprint. You have got to keep yourself in shape mentally and physically. That means eating the right stuff. That means going to sleep at the right time. That means practicing appropriate self-care. That means having relationships that really fill you up, so you do have the energy to do the hard work. You are building an empire. You are going to have bigger team members. You're going to have more balls in the air at all times. How are you going to keep doing that? How is that going to look when you have 10 team members, 20 team members, 25, 40? What's it going to look like when you have that newborn at home and you're trying to do all this too, right? So it's a marathon, not a sprint. So be planning for that long haul, because you can't put in the hours you need to do as an entrepreneur if you are not fit enough to do it mentally or physically. And then the third is just being surrounded by people that you really are inspired by. Maybe people that you like and respect and admire, that people that teach you something every single day, people that are doing bigger business deals than you. Like, one of my good friends is Erin Baker from Baker's Breakfast Cookies. And she is constantly on a plane doing the coolest business deals, right? Selling to all of Kroger's.
And she's selling cookies.
Right, cookies.
That's awesome.
And
that's a dream job.
She's basically selling oatmeal in a cookie, right? Because it's not cookie. It's a really healthy thing, right? Sweetened with just prune juice, right? And so, but she's doing these really amazing, cool business deals that, since I'm direct to consumer, I don't do. And I don't have any access to those. But she'll tell me about the meeting. She'll tell me about how the opening gambit was. She'll tell me about negotiations. And I'm learning so much by having her in my life as a friend. And so just hanging out with people that are doing really cool, inspiring things, and it doesn't have to be in your industry, even better if it's not, because then you can take things that you've learned and bring it back to your own industry, which is kind of what you're trying to do with this podcast.
So besides your book, which is Live Your Best Day Ever, what other books would you recommend? Because everybody should read that book.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Let's see. The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People by Stephen Covey is, of course, just a solid that is one I read every few years. It's so good. I love Firestarter Sessions by Daniel Laporte, which is all about kind of trying to figure out what you want your core desired feelings to be, as opposed to what you want the things to be. So, like, I want to feel joy every day, right? I want to feel vibrant every day. Okay, so what do you need to do that? That's kind of what that book is about. I love The Success Principles by Jack Canfield. It's such a good book. It takes forever to get through because there's so many exercises, but it's just phenomenal. Darren Hardy has a book called The Compound Effect that I love. It's all about habits. That one is just fantastic. And so those are, like, if you're going to read 4 books, just go read those ones. And if you can put even 10% of those books into practice, like, you'll be so much further along. You know, success is not giant leaps and bounds, right? It's, you know, Britney Spears was on the Disney Club for like 6 years and then doing beauty pageants and that kind of stuff before. She had been a performer since she was 4. And then she finally got famous at 18 and everyone was like, oh, where did this wonder come from, right? Lady Gaga, she went to what, Carnegie, right? Like, where did they come from? No. They had 2 decades of working on this stuff, right? Getting better 5%, 10% of time, 10% of the time, never more than that.
The 20-year overnight success.
Right. And so, like, you and I can do that too. We can all do that, get better every single day in little ways. And then in 10 years, because little tiny daily habits compounded by time produce great results.
Wow. I'm going to let that sit for a second. I do kind of have this hunch that you can do a really good Britney impression. Can you do a quick Britney impression?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. Is it? Oh, I feel like I need more wine, but like, hit me, baby, one more time. My loneliness is killing me. And I must confess, I still believe. If I'm not losing, I lose my mind. Give me a sign. Hit me, baby, one more time.
I feel good.
Like I'm very red now. Thank you very much for that.
I'm just here to push you out of your comfort zone.
I've never done karaoke, so.
But I think you'd probably do pretty well at it. Well, you've been an absolute joy to have on the show. We're almost done with this bottle of wine, so we're working on it. But thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for telling us about you and being vulnerable and just being here and being present. Sometimes I know we get caught up in our busy lives, and it means a lot to me because I've learned a lot, and I know that all of us here have learned a lot from you, and we admire you.
Well, and that's nice of you to say. And thank you for having me on and letting me talk for an hour and a half. And thanks for coming to that first political fundraiser you came to at my house. Will be many more.
Yes. And I'll be there.
I'm excited.
I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
It's going to be awesome.
Boom.
Boom.
Again, I'm your host, Leo Cohen, with the Cohen Group Northwest. This episode was produced and edited by David Pender Lofgren. It was recorded and mixed by Andy Rick at Binary Studios. Our social media Jedi is Cooper Hansley. Our blogger is Tiffany Holden. Our theme music was written and performed by Aaron Guest, and our logo was designed by Sam Boat. Building Bellingham is a proud member of the Bell Pod Network, a collective of independent podcasts made right here in the city of subdued excitement. For show notes and links, visit www.livebellinghamnow.com/blog.